And the book of Leviticus, hey, it does not get much airplay, does it? It is not on the top 40. When is the last time you heard those words, grab your Bibles and turn to the book of Leviticus? Not very often. And if you're in a, as I would recommend for you, and many of you are, in like a one-year read-through-the-Bible plan, man, those weeks in Leviticus, they're tough sledding at times, right? It's a little harder work than Ephesians, right? Bit of a difference. We don't read Leviticus that much. It doesn't seem relevant to our situation. We know it's scripture. We know it's valuable. It just doesn't connect with us like reading the Gospel of John, right? And it's filled with strange rituals that we don't do. It's filled with detailed laws which we don't seem to keep. It's filled with sacrifices and blood. Lots of blood. Like lots of blood, right? If they made a film about Leviticus, it'd be rated R, right? It would not be a family film. And we may find it hard to connect with the book of Leviticus, but here in this book, we see pictures of God's holiness and our sinfulness and how it's possible for this untouchably holy God to relate to such an unholy people. That's the picture that we get in Leviticus. God is using a whole bunch of vivid, unforgettable, even grotesque pictures to teach his people about holiness and sin and forgiveness and the grace that comes through substitution. Okay? And so, in these series of pictures, the climax, the best picture, where we reach the climax, is in chapter 16 with this annual event called the Day of Atonement, which we just read. And really, the first two verses, which we're going to look at just right away here, and then we're going to do something else, but the first two verses show us why the Day of Atonement is so important. Look at this, verse 1. The Lord spoke to Moses after the death of the two sons of Aaron. Okay, we're going to look into that. When they drew near before the Lord and died, and the Lord said to Moses, "Tell Aaron, your brother, not to come at any time into the holy place inside the veil before the mercy seat that is on the ark, so that he may not die. For I will appear in the cloud over the mercy seat." Okay, so Yahweh God tells Moses to warn Aaron, his brother, who is the high priest, to never enter the holy place. Don't go there. Don't enter the holy place. Now, the holy place is the innermost part of the tent of meeting. Now, the tent of meeting is this very large tent which was built following very specific instructions from God. In the center, it was placed in the center of the camp for Israel, so they were surrounding the tent of meeting. And it stood as the symbol of the very presence of God in their midst. Okay, and so the tent of meeting is where God resides with his people, and the holy place, which is the very innermost part, becomes the very place where God resides above this mercy seat. Okay, so it's a little mysterious, but this is what's happening with the tent of meeting in the holy place. And Aaron is told, never go in there. Don't go in there. But now before this, God appeared to his people in a cloud of smoke, right? We remember that in Exodus. But now his dwelling place is in the holy place, the innermost part of the tent of meeting. He's right in the camp with them. But Aaron is warned to never go in there as his sons did. And it ended badly for them. So let's actually back up to Leviticus chapter 10. There's just a couple verses I want to read there, because it's referencing a certain event, right? We want to see what he's talking about when he says referencing this event. Verses Leviticus 10, 1-3. Now Nadab and Abihu, the sons of Aaron, each took his censer and put fire in it and laid incense on it and offered unauthorized fire before the Lord, which he had not commanded them. And fire came out from before the Lord and consumed them, and they died before the Lord. Then Moses said to Aaron, "This is what the Lord has said. Among those who are near me, I will be sanctified, set apart, made holy." That's what that word means. "And before all the people, I will be glorified." And Aaron held his peace. So Nadab and Abihu, they decided that God's instructions just didn't really specifically matter. They got sloppy, and they approached God with a recklessness. They start, making their own rules. They start approaching God in their own way and approach him with carelessness or recklessness. But God will not be messed with. He will not be defamed like that. And so he will, he says, he will be set apart as holy. He will be revered, period. Okay? So now, we might ask the question, and be a good question, why would Nadab and Abihu do something like this? Why would they approach God like this? Why the carelessness? And I want to go back to, join me if you'd like, to Exodus 19. Exodus 19, I'll read it, so if you don't want to turn, that's fine. But Exodus 19, starting in verse 16. Now this is shortly after the event we read about last week, with the Passover. The people come out, they come up to Mount Sinai, and they meet this God who just saved them. This is Exodus 19, we'll start in verse 16. It says, "On the morning of the third day, there were thunders and lightning and a thick cloud on the mountain and a very loud trumpet blast, so that all the people in the camp trembled. Then Moses brought the people out of the camp to meet God, and they took their stand at the foot of the mountain. Now Mount Sinai was wrapped in smoke because the Lord had descended on it in fire. The smoke of it went up like the smoke of a kiln, and the whole mountain trembled greatly. And as the sound of the trumpet grew louder and louder, Moses spoke, and God answered him in thunder." Okay, now, and then he starts to speak, and he gives them the Ten Commandments, and makes this covenant with them. That's Exodus, the end of 19 and into 20. Now jump down to Exodus 20, verse 18. "Now when all the people..." So this is when God has finished speaking. "Now when all the people saw the thunder and the flashes of lightning and the sound of the trumpet and the mountain smoking, the people were afraid and trembled, and they stood far off and said to Moses," this is great, "said to Moses, 'You speak to us and we will listen, but do not let God speak to us, lest we die.' Moses said to the people, 'Do not fear, for God has come to test you, that the fear of him may be before you, that you may not sin.' The people stood far off while Moses drew near to the thick darkness where God was." So God speaks to his people, and they say, I love it, they say to Moses when they hear God's voice, "Please don't let him do that to us again. I mean, you speak, you tell us what he says, we will do whatever you want. Just don't let him speak anymore, because it will kill us if we hear his voice again." I mean, the whole place is trembling and smoking and trumpets and fire, and it's like a massive earthquake mixed with a volcano when God speaks to them. And they say, we will do whatever you want. Trust me, just don't let him speak to us again. We cannot survive it. And there is this holy fear, a reverence for God. They understand his holiness and power and might. And in this moment, they take him seriously. That they understand that he is God and they are not. That they understand that very clearly. But over time, something happens. As God descends the mountain and dwells in the tent of meeting, in their very presence, some people lost that reverence. They lost that holy fear, that proper distinction between who is God and who isn't. Some people lost that. Nadab and Abihu approached the Holy One of Israel without thought or care. And it had devastating results, because he will be revered. He will be made holy and held in fear and holiness. And so we get to this elaborate ceremony in Leviticus 16. You can flip back there. As we get to this elaborate ceremony, this Day of Atonement, God is showing us that he is no less holy now than when he first spoke from that mountain back in Exodus 19. Leviticus 16 drives home the truth that God is just as holy and demands just as much reverence when he dwells permanently with his people as on that first occasion on Mount Sinai. And the purpose of these rituals in this chapter is to make it possible, to make it possible for God in all his holiness and splendor and glory and righteousness to dwell and continue to dwell in the presence of such an unholy, vile people. I mean, how those two can intersect is only possible because of the rituals in the Day of Atonement. And so in order for such a holy God and such an unholy people to coexist, to have relationship, atonement has to be made. Okay? So this word atonement becomes critical to understanding this chapter. Atonement is the necessary step before forgiveness can happen. Before forgiveness from God is possible, atonement has to be made. See, atonement is the the cleansing or removing of the sin or the offense. Once removed, forgiveness can follow. But forgiveness cannot happen without atonement, without the offense being removed or covered or cleansed or taken care of. See, with forgiveness, there is always a cost. There's always a cost. Someone always has to pay. For instance, let's say that you steal $50 from me. And you steal from me, and then you feel bad about it after, and you come and ask for my forgiveness. Now, justice is required. Either you can repay the debt, or I can swallow it up myself, but someone has to pay. In order for forgiveness to happen, justice has to happen as well. Atonement has to be made. It can be made by either you repaying, and now there's no debt between us. I forgive you. Or I can choose to swallow it myself. I can choose to pay it myself. The options aren't you can pay it or no one can pay it, because if you don't pay it, I'm paying it. I lost the $50. I have to swallow it myself and say it's gone. It's forgiven. It is covered. I will cover the debt myself. Someone has to pay. The debt must be settled. Now, it's also true for other offenses that don't involve money. For instance, if you say something cruel to me, and then later you feel bad and come back and ask for forgiveness, I have two options if I'm going to forgive you. I can either hold it against you and punish you in some way, right? We do this, where I'm going to be cold back to you for a certain amount of time, maybe a week or two. Or I'm going to say something mean back. Or I'm going to treat you in some unfavorable way for a certain amount of time until I feel like the debt has been satisfied. This is what we do, right? We hold it against someone for a little while, and sometimes it's a big deal, and we hold it against them for a long time, and sometimes it's just a short thing, and we're just kind of, you know, give them the silent treatment for a day or something. We're just not nice to them and back, and what we're doing is we're punishing them. We're making them pay the debt. Or the other option is, I can pay the debt myself, and not punish you, and not make you pay it back, but then I'm swallowing the debt myself. I'm forgiving, and I'm saying the debt is covered, it won't come back. Either way, someone has to pay. For forgiveness to happen, it always has to cost. This is why forgiveness is really hard, because it always costs. There's always a price. You have to let go. You have to get rid of that thing you hold against the person. You hold something over them, but you have to let it go. You have to pay it back. You have to swallow it yourself in order for forgiveness to happen. See, forgiveness without cost isn't actually forgiveness. Because if the debt hasn't been paid, but has just been temporarily set aside for a more convenient time when maybe you can act on it later, that's not forgiveness, right? That's just a temporary peace agreement for a moment. But I'm going to bring back the debt later that you still owe me from that time. See, that's not actually forgiveness. That's not forgiveness. For real forgiveness to happen, someone has to pay the debt. It has to be swallowed up by someone. And atonement is the paying of the debt, the required pre-work before forgiveness. It's where justice and mercy meet. Okay? And in this passage, Leviticus 16, God prescribes a process of atonement. He's showing us and gives, by His grace, this gift of how He will swallow up the cost. God has committed Himself to swallowing up the cost Himself. And this is the process of how He's going to do it. Okay, so we're going to look at this process and see what it means and why it's significant. So here's the process of atoning for sin so forgiveness can be made and so God can forgive and His presence can continue to dwell with these unholy people. Look at verse 3. We're going to walk through this section. But in this way, Aaron shall come into the holy place with a bull from the herd for a sin offering and a ram for a burnt offering. He shall put on the holy linen coat and shall have the linen undergarment on his body, and he shall tie the linen sash around his waist and wear the linen turban. These are the holy garments. He shall bathe his body in water and then put them on. He shall take from the congregation of the people of Israel two male goats for a sin offering and one ram for a burnt offering. So Aaron has a special outfit, a Day of Atonement outfit. Now, what's special about this outfit is, from the context of Leviticus that you'll notice, is that compared to the other 364 days, this is a very plain and simple outfit. normally Aaron has this just ridiculously elaborate, fancy outfit that drew attention to his very special role and as the high priest, and it had beautiful colors, this very intricate embroidery. It was covered with gold and jewelry. I mean, he was dressed like a powerful, powerful, wealthy king. That's the everyday work clothes that he wore, except on the Day of Atonement. On this day, he wore just a simple, plain, white linen outfit. See, among the people of Israel, he is elevated. He is dressed in glorious clothing. But in the presence of God, he's dressed like a simple slave. There's nothing flamboyant. There's nothing fancy. There's nothing glorious. There's no honor in his clothing here. He may have been the greatest of men in among the people of Israel, but in God's presence, he's just dressed as a simple servant. Okay? Now, follow verse 6. Aaron shall offer the bull as a sin offering for himself and shall make atonement for himself and his house. Then he shall take the two goats and set them before the Lord at the entrance of the tent of meeting. And Aaron shall cast lots over the two goats, one lot for the Lord and one lot for Azazel. And Aaron shall present the goat on which the lot fell for the Lord and use it as a sin offering. But the goat on which the lot fell for Azazel shall be presented alive before the Lord to make atonement over it, that it may be sent away into the wilderness to Azazel. All right, so this is actually an overview, an intro to what's going to happen next. First, Aaron is going to sacrifice a bull to atone for himself and for the other priests. And then he's going to take two goats and he's going to cast lots. He's going to roll dice and see which goat goes where. One goat is for the Lord, which will be sacrificed as an offering for sin. And one goat will be for Azazel, which we're going to look at what that means later. And that's going to be sent away into the wilderness. Okay? Make sense? Verse 11. Aaron shall present the bull as a sin offering for himself, as we said, and shall make atonement for himself and for his house. He shall kill the bull as a sin offering for himself, and he shall take a censer full of coals of fire from the altar before the Lord, and two handfuls of sweet incense beaten small, and he shall bring it inside the veil, and put the incense on the fire before the Lord, that the cloud of the incense may cover the mercy seat that is over the testimony, so that he does not die. And he shall take some of the blood of the bull and sprinkle it with his finger on the front of the mercy seat and on the east side, and in front of the mercy seat he shall sprinkle some of the blood with his finger seven times. Okay, what's going on here? Now, this is the one and only time that Aaron ever enters the holy place, this innermost place where there's the mercy seat over which God dwells in a cloud. And so what's significant here is in order for him to enter this holy place, he gets this this incense and this fire, and so it's creating a lot of smoke. And it says that the smoke will cover the mercy seat. So in order for him to enter the holy place, he comes with this billowing smoke of incense so that it covers it. So even when he goes in, the one time he goes in, he smokes the place out so that he can't even see the mercy seat, lest he look upon the very presence of God and die. You see the significance, pretty scary thing. And he has to take every precaution in order to approach God in his infinite holiness. And has to be very careful in how he does this. Verse 15. We'll keep moving. Then he shall kill the goat of the sin offering that is for the people, and bring its blood inside the veil, and do with its blood as he did with the blood of the bull, sprinkling it over the mercy seat in front of the mercy seat. Thus he shall make atonement for the holy place, because of the uncleannesses of the people of Israel, and because of their transgressions, all their sins. And so he shall do for the tent of meeting, which dwells with them in the midst of their uncleannesses. No one may be in the tent of meeting from the time he enters to make atonement in the holy place until he comes out and has made atonement for himself and for his house and for all the assembly of Israel. Then he shall go out to the altar that is before the Lord and make atonement for it, and shall take some of the blood of the bull and some of the blood of the goat and put it on the horns of the altar all around. And he shall sprinkle some of the blood on it with his finger seven times, and shall cleanse it and consecrate it from the uncleannesses of the people of Israel. Okay, so the sacrifice of the bull is now for the purification of the priests, and the sacrifice of the goat is for the purification of the people. And see, the sin and their unclean nature of the people has defiled everything. just being in the presence. They're such an unclean people because of their sin and their brokenness and their humanity that they've actually kind of infected everything. Their presence has defiled everything. And so for God to continue, a holy God to continue to exist in the presence of an unholy people, I mean, just the very tent of meeting, the very altar, the whole, even all the entire tent and everything in it has become unclean because the people are around it, just because they're in their presence. And so the sacrifices have to be made to cleanse by this ritual, this process, to cleanse all these objects of worship so that God can continue to exist amongst such an impure people. So they make atonement so that God can continue to be in relationship with his people. Now let's look at verse 20. I think this is the real climax of the passage. And when he has made an end of atoning for the holy place and the tent of meeting and the altar, he shall present the live goat. Okay, so there was two goats. He sacrificed the one. This is the second goat. This is the goat for Azazel. And Aaron shall lay both his hands on the head of the live goat and confess over it all the iniquities of the people of Israel and all their transgressions, all their sins. And he shall put them on the head of the goat and send it away into the wilderness by the hand of a man who is in readiness. The goat shall bear all their iniquities on itself to a remote area, and he shall let the goat go free in the wilderness. Okay? It's a pretty significant little process here. So Aaron takes this second goat, the one that's the lot called for Azazel, and he brings the goat before the entire people so everyone can see. He shows them the goat. And then he kneels down and he puts both his hands and lays them on the head of this goat. And then he confesses sin, the iniquities, transgressions, the sins, all the evil, all the breaking of rules, all the evil things, all the sinful things, all the unclean things that the nation has done, that all the people have done. As they watch him, he confesses these things while his hands on the head of this goat. And he confesses all the filth and vile of the people. And then all the sin, all the error, all the iniquities, transgressions, all these words they use, all the evil of the people are transferred from those people to the goat. They're symbolically laid on the goat's head. And this goat now bears the sin and filth and evil of the entire people. It's all taken and laid on this goat. And in God's eyes, the sin of the people now rests on this one goat. He bears it for them all. And then the goat is sent away into the wilderness to a remote area to die. And remote area, literally, it's called a land of cutting off. It seems to refer to a remote place that is somehow cut off from the camp, like a deep valley or something like that, so that the goat can never come back. It's cut off from life, cut off from the people, never to return. It's isolated, and so it's sent away to be isolated, separated, and to die. And this ceremony removes the sins of the people, places them on the goat, who carries them far off to an unclean place, the wilderness, to never return. Far away, cut off from life, from God, and from his people. Now, throughout the book of Leviticus, to be sent outside the camp is a significant thing. It's not like you're going on a go for a walk or something. Outside the camp is to be under the judgment of God. Outside the camp is where punishment happens. To send the goat outside the camp, far away from the tent of meeting, the symbolic dwelling place of God, is to send the goat out to be punished and to be killed for its sin. Okay? That's what it means to be sent outside the camp. Now, this word Azazel, we wonder about that, right? Azazel is a Hebrew name. And so, one for the Lord, one for Azazel. Azazel is a name. Now, what that name is referring to, we're not entirely sure. Some people think that it refers to like a demon who lives in the wilderness. The idea being you're sending sin back to its source. So Azazel is the name of the demon. Maybe. It might be the name of the specific place where the goat is sent. So that's the name of the cliff or the valley or the place, the specific place where they sent him. Or it might be, some people have looked at the words, the Hebrew word and see it as, and try to translate it, and some people have translated it as complete destruction. So one goat is for the Lord, one is for complete destruction. Now, traditionally, it's been understood as a compound of the Hebrew words for goat and the Hebrew word for going away, where the meaning is, this is one for the Lord and one is the goat for sending away. And so this is where we actually get the term scapegoat, the goat that bears the blame and is sent away. So no matter what it's meant, I mean, I'm not really sure which term, and it's not really actually relevant, but the meaning, the idea is clear either way. The goat carries the sins of the people out into the wilderness to die alone, cut off from the people, cut off from the presence of God, never, ever, ever to return. So it's this clear and vivid picture of God removing the sin and filth from the people, the blame of the people, and placing on this substitute that carries it far away from them, never to return, never to come back. I mean, it's a powerful picture. You can literally watch your sin being removed from you. You can literally watch it being carried off one step at a time, further and further, increasing in distance, off into the horizon, beyond the horizon, and gone, never to return. You can watch God taking your sin from you and marching it off to death. You can actually watch your sin walking away on four legs. There it goes, never to come back. Now, what happens next is, in verses 23 to 28, there's this really specific and elaborate cleanup process. Aaron's holy garments must stay in the holy place until next year. He has to bathe and put another sacrifice for himself and for the people. The guy who carried the goat off into the wilderness, he has to wash and come back and change his clothes before entering the camp again. See, because the sinful goat has defiled him because he's come in contact with it. And the remains of the sacrifices have to be carried outside the camp, again, outside the camp, and dumped there and burned. Not even the remains can stay in the camp, right? So there's this whole process. And then in verse 29 to 31, we see what all the people are to do on the Day of Atonement, right? So then there's the whole congregation. What did the people of Israel do? Look at verse 29. And it shall be a statute to you forever that in the seventh month and the tenth day of that month, you shall afflict yourselves and shall do no work, either the native or the stranger who sojourns among you. For on this day shall atonement be made for you to cleanse you. You shall be clean before the Lord from all your sins. It is a Sabbath of solemn rest to you, and you shall afflict yourselves. It is a statute forever. When it's talking about afflicting yourself, it's probably talking about a fast. So we're not eating today. It's also a Sabbath, so there's no work, and they're going to afflict themselves with a fast, no eating. And so the significance is this. On the day that atonement is made, what do the people do? On the day when God extends forgiveness and cleanses them of their sin, what are they busy doing? Nothing. And they're not eating, they're not working, they're not doing anything. The day that God makes everything right, they do nothing. God does everything. On the day, what do they accomplish on the Day of Atonement? Nothing. They're not allowed to do anything. Because God wants to make it very clear who does the atoning. He wants to make it very clear who swallows the debt. He wants to make it very clear to them, abundantly clear, that they do nothing, He does everything. If they are to be clean and righteous and able to continue in relationship with God, it is because He has acted and they have received, not the other way around. Okay? And so God swallows the debt Himself while they do nothing and watch. They just watch. Now, this is the part where we say, what? Why don't we do this? And how is this relevant to me, right? And now you've been thinking that up until this moment. Why are we talking about this? Flip over to Hebrews chapter 9. I know I'm making you work today. Hey, we're working for it. Hebrews 9. Starting in verse 23. The whole book of Hebrews, phenomenal book, where we're learning about how Christ relates to all that has come before Him. I want to look at these few verses. Hebrews 9:23. Thus it was necessary for the copies of the heavenly things to be purified with these rites. In this chapter, he's talking about the Day of Atonement, okay? To be purified with these rites, but the heavenly things themselves with better sacrifices than these. For Christ has entered into holy places made with, or has not into holy places made with hands, which are copies of the true things, but into heaven itself, now to appear in the presence of God on our behalf. nor was it to offer himself repeatedly as the high priest enters the holy places every year with blood not his own, for then he would have had to suffer repeatedly since the foundation of the world. But as it is, he has appeared, this is Christ, he has appeared once for all at the end of the ages to put away sin by the sacrifice of himself. And just as it was appointed for man to die once, and after that comes judgment, so Christ, having been offered once to bear the sins of many, will appear a second time, not to deal with sin, but to save those who are eagerly waiting for him. Now, keep going. For since the law has but a shadow of the good things to come instead of the true form of these realities, it can never, by the same sacrifices that are continually offered every year, make perfect those who draw near. Otherwise, would they not have ceased to be offered, since the worshippers, having once been cleansed, would no longer have any consciousness of sin? But in these sacrifices there is a reminder of sins every year. For it is impossible for the blood of bulls and goats to take away sins. Now jump down to verse 11. Chapter 10, verse 11. And every priest stands daily at his service, offering repeatedly the same sacrifices which can never take away sins. But when Christ had offered for all time a single sacrifice for sins, he sat down at the right hand of God, waiting from that time until his enemies should be made a footstool for his feet. For by a single offering, he has perfected for all time those who are being sanctified. Okay, you see, the Day of Atonement was not a once-for-all answer to the problem of sin. Sin may be atoned for, but it did not fix the problem of sinful hearts. I mean, the Day of Atonement had to happen every single year. And even then, the day after the Day of Atonement, you're going, oh man, we need another Day of Atonement already. It didn't even take us, you know, one day, and we're already in need of another Day of Atonement. The entire Day of Atonement is actually anticipating and foreshadowing and getting us ready for Good Friday, the real Day of Atonement. See, the tent of meeting, the holy place, the sacrifices, these were all shadows, is what Hebrews says. They're all shadows of the fullness to come in Jesus Christ. They were just pictures. They were just symbols getting us ready to help us see what it meant when Jesus Christ came to offer his once-for-all sacrifice. Jesus is our new and better high priest, making a once-for-all atonement by his own blood. See, he approached, as a better high priest, he approached the holy place of God to make atonement, not with the blood of bulls and goats, but by his own sacrifice, his own perfect sacrifice of himself. He says, the author talks about how every day priests make new sacrifices for new sins, right? Every morning, every evening, a lamb is sacrificed for sins of the people. And then there's the Day of Atonement as well. There's other sacrifices continually, nonstop, new sacrifices for new sins all day, every day. That's what a priest would do. There's no chairs in the temple or in the tent of meeting either. Priests don't sit down. There's no break room in the temple. There's no time off. They don't stop. They continually stand and they continually offer sacrifices because their work is never, ever, 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 ever done. Ever. One new sacrifice for a new sin after new sacrifice for new sin. But when Jesus made his sacrifice, he did what? He sat down. It is finished. His job was done. He made his one sacrifice and took his seat. It is finished. He is done. And now he sits at the right hand of God, waiting for God to finish his work of putting Christ's enemies under his foot as a stool to rest his feet on, an ottoman is what his enemies will become. Because he is done. Atonement is made. It is finished. See, we don't keep the Day of Atonement. We don't worry about it. We don't practice the Day of Atonement because it was just a shadow. It was just a hint getting us ready for the real Day of Atonement. The day when Christ made atonement. See, we don't have to go back to the shadow because we got the fullness. We got the real thing. Right? we have the full, significant, once for all meaning of the Day of Atonement in the death of Jesus Christ. It is finished. There's no future atonement to be made. It's done. Once for all. No more sacrifices. No more atonement. No more goats. No more bulls. No more blood. His blood has covered it all. He is done. You see? Not only is Jesus our new and better high priest, bringing us a once for all atonement, God swallowing the debt himself, he, the perfect lamb, the perfect sacrifice, making forgiveness possible, but also, Jesus is our goat of removal. He is our scapegoat. He is the goat for Azazel, carrying our sins away from us, never to return. Hebrews 13, just a little bit later, says, "For the bodies of those animals whose blood is brought into the holy places by the high priest as a sacrifice for sin are burned outside the camp." This is Hebrews 13, verse 12 now. "So Jesus also suffered outside the gate in order to sanctify the people through his own blood." See, just as the goat was led outside the camp to die, so too Jesus was led outside the gates of the city to sanctify the people through his own blood, his own death. See, Jesus is the goat. He is our great substitute. "For our sake, God made him to be sin, who knew no sin, so that in him we might become the righteousness of God." God placed all the sin, all our shame, all our guilt, all our blame, all our filth and defilement and evil, and placed it on Jesus. He was led outside the camp. He was sent away, bearing our sin and shame. And can't you see? Can't you see him walking, carrying your own sin and shame? You can literally stand in the street and watch him carrying your sin and your shame and your blame and your filth away from you, outside the city, to suffer the judgment of God on our behalf. Don't you see your sin and shame walking away? Can't you picture it? The goat is leaving beyond the horizon, disappearing into the distance. You'll never see him again. Cut off forever, eternally removed from you, gone forever, never to return. There go your sins. You won't see them again, so say goodbye. They are going to a place where they cannot return. You may feel shame and guilt and pain from things you've done. I've talked to you, many of you, and you know you've messed up big time. There's mistakes and sin and horrible things that you've done in your past. Things you're not proud of. Things that you carry shame for because of what you've done. And you may feel even dirty and ashamed. That's what sin does. That's what sin does to us. But I'm here to tell you, you don't have to feel that way. You need to know that as you confess your sin, God has removed it from you forever. If you are in Christ, God has placed your sin on Jesus. Therefore, it's not on you. You no longer carry it. You no longer bear it. As the Father looks at you, he sees all the purity and clean and beauty and holiness and righteousness of Jesus. And as the Father looked at the Son, he saw your filth and sin and evil and shame. I mean, this is what it means that Jesus is our great substitute. My sin for his righteousness. The great exchange. Sometimes people ask, talk to people and they ask, is God punishing me for my sin in this certain event I'm going through, in this situation? Is this punishment for my sin? The answer is emphatically no. No. God does not punish the same sin over and over again. That's not fair. That's unjust. If you are a follower of Christ who has confessed your sin to God and placed your faith in Jesus Christ for salvation, your sin has already fully and exhaustively been punished. It is finished. Christ has already paid the debt. The debt has been paid. The sentence has been executed. Atonement has been made. The goat has been sent away. It is gone, never to return. God will not punish you a second time for sin that he's already punished in Jesus Christ. You need to know, and I'm here to tell you today, that the goat has left the building. It is gone, and it will never, ever, ever, ever return, ever. You will not see it again. It is gone to be cut off, to be gone forever, to lose its life in your place. As far as the east is from the west, so far He has removed your transgressions from you. It is gone forever because of Jesus Christ.